All right. Thank you to Ron for stepping in the last two times. He did 3 weeks ago, then we had the joint service, then he did last week for us. And appreciate that very much. We're in the third chapter of 1 Timothy. So if you have your Bibles, you'll want to turn there. This is, first of all, a very interesting portion of Scripture. It can also be a very controversial portion of Scripture. There are a lot of varied views. There are some things that I think people have taken and used this that don't really apply, and we'll talk about some of those things. And I'm not going to say that just to attack any one of your positions. But I think, again, we need to look at, see what the Scripture says and what Paul's trying to help us understand here. And we'll work through some of these things. And who knows, we may all be all in agreement about the whole thing and just go home. I don't know. But so let's look at this. He's going to be talking initially in this third chapter about what we as Baptists would say would be the two offices of a church. Not just officers, but the two offices, the two biblical offices of a New Testament church are. And by the way, if you ever do that, what's that called? That acrostic, that Baptist thing? Is that what it's called, acrostic?
Yeah.
Did I get that right?
Yeah.
Oh, hey. And one of the T's stand, you know, it talks about Bible believing and autonomy of the local church and priesthood of believers and two ordinances and independent soul liberty and separation of church and state and two offices and what's the last S? See, I blew it on the last S. I got pretty good. I got the Baptist, so. Anyway. But one of them is the two offices. We believe like there's two ordinances. We don't believe in, you know, Roman Catholics have like what they call 12 sacraments. And we, first of all, we don't believe in sacraments. We don't teach sacraments. We believe ordinances. And they are never to dispense grace, but they are because you have received the grace of God in salvation. You're a partaker of those things. We also believe the New Testament teaches not a hierarchy of offices in the church, which would start, you know, again, Roman Catholics probably, I use them because they're probably the most evident of the hierarchy system. You got popes, and then you got cardinals, and you got bishops, and you got monsignors, and you got priests, and, you know, you got that big hierarchy and stuff. Well, we believe that the Bible teaches just two offices, okay? And the first office would be the offices of pastor, or other terms that are used there. What are some of the other terms used?
Overseer.
Elder.
Bishop.
Some would even say presbyter is in there somewhere. Pastor, teacher, that would be one office. And depending on who's writing and what he's trying to say, he'll use different things there. And then the other office would be that of deacon. Okay, which is why we as Baptists ordain deacons along with ordaining pastors. They're officially set aside in the church for service in that office. Mary, do you have a question?
I did.
Go ahead.
How does this meld with Ephesians 4, where I was taught that those are referred to as offices of the church?
Yeah.
Apostle, prophet, evangelist, da 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 da. How do they mesh?
Well, I'm not sure that when I look at those five, they call it a fivefold, or some tie two of them together, pastor, teacher, together. I don't look at them so much as offices, as how Paul says that he gives gifts to men. I see them as the gifts of God to the church. You have the prophet, okay? You have the evangelist, okay? And you have the what is it? Prophet,
teacher, pastor, and apostle,
prophet, evangelist.
Apostle, yeah. Now again, we would say we still have apostles in the small A sense. I would say every missionary that goes out is an apostle, mm-hmm. in a small A sense. We would not say, like some who believe in continuation of the apostolic office, we don't believe we have an apostolic office today. Okay? Prophet. I don't believe we have an office or an official position of prophet. Now, did the New Testament church need prophets? Of course it. Just read the book of Revelation. You have a prophet right there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? But we don't have anybody that fulfills that office of prophet today. I believe Hebrews makes it pretty clear that Jesus does that. Okay? And then evangelists, well, certainly the church still has evangelists, like we still have missionary, but we don't. Every local church does not have an official office of evangelists, and then a pastor teacher. So you can almost look at this way. You can almost look at these two offices as being the offices for the local church, and you could make an argument that those fivefold are the work of God in the universal church.
So
in the church as a whole.
They're the gifts that wash through those offices.
Yeah. And some people believe they've not ceased. You can have a long discussion on that. But to me, I'd really think that what Paul is talking about there is not so much a local church office as much as the church itself, which would be included in the church overall. Any thoughts, guys? Okay. Well, we got one agreement tonight. So we'll move on. So, all right. So, we look here, and he begins this chapter by saying, "This is a faithful saying," which means what?
It's important.
It's important. What else?
Trustworthy.
It's trustworthy, which means it is true. Which must mean that, you know, by default, if you will, the source of this is the Holy Spirit of God, who is giving instructions, I think, particularly now, through Paul to Timothy and to any other local New Testament churches that come along on particularly these off. Now, Ron shared with you last week some biblical information on worship in the New Testament church. And not so much style and not so much method, but intent and making sure that it is glorifying. I mean, we can go. I don't want to go through everything. I didn't get to hear him because he didn't tape it. But so I've done that many times. So, anyways, but now he's going to come to these two offices, and so he begins by saying, "This is a faithful or a trustworthy say. If a man desires a position of bishop, he desires a good work." Now, you can't even imagine on pastor boards, and I don't want to get into how many arguments come from right there. Seems to me a pretty benign statement, but the issue is, are pastors called, or is it something that they desire? Yeah. I would go along with that. I would think part of the call process would be that the Lord would put in the heart of a man to serve as a pastor. If it's for a season, you can fool people if it's just an occupation. And it doesn't take long, I don't think, with people with discernment that can tell the difference between someone who is just there to get a paycheck and do what he does, and someone who has a call of God, who puts the desire in the heart of a pastor? When I talk about pastors, I think a lot that there are a lot who are called that don't even answer the call. I think there's some people, I've met people through my ministry that I had, it, from my perspective, had a great call in their life, but too many other things going on. They had to make a decision, like any of us have to make a decision, whether or not that they were going to give their life to that. He's trying to say that this is a good thing, but there's a lot of other verses in the New Testament that gives caution, if you will. You know, James seems to discourage this when he says, "Don't many of you desire to be teachers? Because there'll be much more, there'll be much more required of you." And I've shared with you before, I had a who I thought was an excellent Sunday school teacher in my first church in Tucson. He read James, that verse, and he said, "I quit." And it was Tom Taylor, and he said, "I quit." He said, "I don't want that responsibility." And then my response was, and I don't know what was right back then, but I think it's affirmed through the years. I said, "Tom, let me tell you something. You can quit if you want to, but it doesn't change the responsibility of the call of God upon your life. You've been called to be a teacher. You've been gifted to be a teacher. If you choose not to do it, you're still accountable for that."
That's a good answer.
So, you know, the call has, certainly we would all say, has to come from God. But there has to be, like any other thing, when God moves in something, there has to be a response. So I think in verse 1, he's talking more about the response of the person who has a call of the Holy Spirit. Is your heart ready to be surrendered to God so that he can use you in that place? Because there are requirements that go along with this. And there are some things that disqualify a man from serving as a pastor. Doesn't disqualify, listen to me, they don't disqualify them from ministry. And I think we have to make that distinction. But he takes great care to talk about these two offices and the qualifications that go with these offices. Okay? I think pastors can do things that will disqualify them from being pastor. Can God forgive them? Yes. Can God still use them? Yes. But I think there are some things that can disqualify them. All right, so he says that they need to have that desire or that willingness to respond to the call of the Holy Spirit. Okay? Now he goes, anything else before I go to verse 2? Go ahead, Ron.
He says here that word, it's a good thing, but it can also be translated noble, honorable, or even valuable. I mean, there's a significance to it. It's a good and wonderful thing. If God puts that on.
It is legitimate. There's a lot of things claimed even in the church and Christendom today as to be works of God. Paul makes it clear that this is a work of God. Okay, so it is a good thing and it is significant, and it is there's a responsibility that comes with it.
I think we're in a day where a lot of people discount the call.
Yeah.
You know, I grew up, and you did too, at a time where that was pretty much assumed and expected, that you don't just decide I'm going to be a minister.
Right.
And I think today our schools and some of these things are having to deal with a different mentality where they see it and they say, man, that looks pretty good to me. I would discourage that real quick.
I would agree.
It's not something that you.
There's a school of thought.
Out.
Yeah, there's
God seeks you.
And there's a school of thought that I know you're aware of too, and that is the school of thought teaching the pastor being the CEO.
Yeah, it's all good.
So to in some schools teaching pastors how to be a CEO.
Yeah.
Well, we can get a long discussion about even some of the mega churches where the senior pastor is. That's what he is. He's a CEO, and he's the personality. But he's not allowed to do
ministry,
pastoring. He's not allowed to pastor. He's a speaker, and he and certainly probably a great administrator in the sense of those things. But in order to, you know, he cannot pastor his people. It's just an impossibility. You cannot surround a pastor in his own church with half a dozen security guards and take him in and off the stage and him have any contact with his people. And you, to me, there's an evident thing there. Just try to walk into one of their offices sometime.
I couldn't get it.
You can't get in my office because Donna's there. She's gonna knock you out. But I'm serious. Just try to walk in one of her. You can't. They cannot be your pastor.
I couldn't get an appointment with the pastor of a megachurch. I couldn't even get to see them.
Yeah. When we were talking to Luke, because Luke did music and stuff over at Phoenix First Assembly, so we called to do the background check like we do on all of you. We check on all of you. So we did call to do the background check, and they said to the person on the committee, you can't speak to Pastor, Barnett, Luke Barnett, I think is the pastor's son. No, Tommy's ahead, but Luke now is the senior pastor. His son is. And he said, you can't talk to him. We'll have to transfer you to the PR department.
What?
No, HR. HR, not PR. I'm sorry, HR. Thank you. So.
I can understand.
It's a model that I'm not comfortable with. I'm not saying that God's not using it. Please don't misunderstand what I'm saying. But it's a model of pastoring that I'm not comfortable with. Someone told me, you'll never be a pastor of a huge church. I said, well, okay. I mean, I'm not going to lose any sleep over that stuff. I like being able to have you walk in the office if you can get by Donna. All you guys get by easy. Just don't come in trying to be a salesman and get by. She won't let you by. So.
I like George Truett, you know, when he said he prayed to have a pastor's heart.
Yeah.
And of course, he went through a lot of, I think, tragic experiences, but he came to have that.
Yeah.
And he refused then, and at other times he had offering of being maybe a president of a school and other kinds of stuff. And he said, no, I've sought to have a pastor's heart.
Yeah.
Of course, it was a big church, but still.
Yeah. It was, Kelly, were you going to shut up?
He should respond by, well, then I'll have your people, I'll have my people call.
Call your people. Then go home and say, Teresa, call him. Paul.
I kind of listened to what you said about those people that neglect the calling, walk away from it. The flip side of that, I think, is, and we often discount this, but we serve a God who is a pursuing God. And he pursues until, and he's a relentless pursuer. And I think that should be, you know, and when they walk away, they're going to encounter.
Oh, yeah. Especially if they have the call.
There's going to be hell to pay.
Well, and I know some of the guys, they were like, six or seven of us that surrendered to ministry at the same time at First Baptist Chandler that I did. I'm the only one left. And there's a lot of hurt and resentment, regret in a lot of those guys' life because they knew the call was there, you know. So, yeah, you know, but here's the other thing, and here's what when a young guy comes and tells me he's feeling the call, one of the indicators for me that I tell him, I said, if there's anything else you'd rather do, go do it. Because to enter into this, with it in the back of your mind, there's another thing I could be doing or want to be doing is a very dangerous thing. You have to have a focused heart on God. This is what God, and if nobody affirms that, it's still got to be what God's. You know, some days in the ministry, all you have is your call, and you know that's what you got. You know, so we've been blessed. We've served in four very affirming churches for us. But I know some guys that they get no affirmation at all. So
there's a tragic aspect to that. If you go and look at the statistics, and they're out there, even just in Southern Baptist life, to see how many pastors drop out of the ministry every year. And it isn't always just because they said, I don't want to do this anymore. Some of it's the devil. Some of it's a lack of affirmation. Some of it's burnout.
Some of it's moral failure.
Yeah, there's all kinds of reason that happens, but it happens on such a large scale, and it's largely kind of shoved under the rug. And all kinds of things. You know, the devil's good at attacking marriages, you know, there's all kinds of things. And if you're one of the... What am I trying to say? It isn't just that, you know, that somebody just abandoned their calling. There could be any number of reasons like that.
And like so many things, even in the church, as I get older, what I see is always the push for the younger. Mm-hmm. When I was younger, I guess it was okay then, but, you know, not now, you're old now. But anyway, I'm not that old yet.
No.
Okay. All right. Let's go on to verse 2. Notice what he says here. By the way, my translation uses bishop. Some will say overseer there.
Yeah.
And that does speak, that speaks more, I think he uses that term because he's speaking more of the office right now.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And he's not speaking specifically as much as he's speaking generally to anybody who would desire to fill that office. And so now he goes in verse 2, he said, and a bishop must be blameless. Now that word blameless does not mean sinless or perfect. I can't tell you how many guys, we go on to the deacon's qualification here. No way we're going to get there tonight for sure, but we go on to that. And I've had guys say, well, I can't match up to that. And I said, well, if you think I can fully match up to the first part, then, you know.
Yeah.
And it's not a matter of always matching up exactly. It has more to do with the intent of the man's heart. We are all sinners, and we all fall short, and we will all still stumble, and hopefully that becomes less and less. But does the pastor desire to have a clean heart, a pure heart? Does he desire to live above reproach, where no one can bring an accusation against him that's going to hold? Now this becomes important later on when he says, "Don't you even listen to an accusation against an elder, except for you have at least two witnesses." And by the way, two witnesses are not someone told you something that someone did. Okay? So there's a high requirement here, but there's also a high requirement on the other end that you don't just listen to rumors and innuendos and stuff. You say, well, what if only one person saw and he actually is guilty? God has a way of bringing all those things out. You know? So he says that he must be blameless, and to me that again is above accusation. Okay,
nothing that would really discredit the message.
Right, because like it or not, the pastor does represent the whole church. You know, certainly the whole church is to represent the whole church. But the pastor does represent the whole church. And if there is continued something in his life that's continued, how can he... And now again, hear what I'm saying. Not that when I preach and stuff, everything in my life that week was perfect and I didn't mess up, didn't say something wrong, didn't think something wrong, stuff like that. But if there's a continuing thing in my life, how can I share truth with you guys? It's such a balance there. It's so hard sometimes. Sometimes it's a heavy burden when you say, "Lord, I can't get up and say this right now because you know what I thought this week, or you know what I said about so and so this week, and you know the kind of person I am. How do I do that?" And there are those the world would say, "How do you dare say anything about anything? Because look at your own life. You're not perfect. If we had to wait for people to be perfect, then the message would never be shared. Because certainly the messenger. That's why I always say the message is greater than the messenger, but the messenger must be right with the giver of the message. That makes sense to you? And so that rightness is in right fellowship and right relationship with the Lord. Before I give a message every Sunday, I'm asking God to cleanse my heart of those things that I don't have, you know, or that maybe I'm not recognizing stuff. And then I ask him to fill me up. And then I ask him to use me. It's my prayer every week. I don't stop, you know, on the way up there and have you all join me or anything, but that's my silent prayer to God every week because I don't, you know, you don't want to get in the way. And you certainly don't want to have anything where someone can say, "You did this. We saw you doing this. You're guilty of this. You cheated people. You did this. You're doing all this kind of stuff." And got to be blameless in that way.
Something that would make you unfit to hold that off.
Right. And there are, again, there are some things that disqualify, you know, old news. So it's so old that I can use it. It was like the swaggered thing. Okay. Unfortunately, what we've seen, the pattern is that a lot of these guys don't say anything until they actually get caught. It's not so much of their burden in their heart and they come. They get caught, then they come. Okay. Could that happen? Certainly could. Could God even use getting caught to bring someone back around? I believe he could do that too. But there was some evidence in Swaggart that there wasn't real repentance there, because even his own church or his own organization said, "You must stay out of the pulpit for at least a year. For your own sake, as much as the gospel's sake." And you know, when he gave his little confession, he said, "Well, I'll clean toilets if that's what it is in the house of God," and stuff like that. A couple months later, he had to be back in the pulpit. So, you know, there are some things, whether they temporarily move a person out of that or permanently move a person out of that role as pastor of the church. Okay. All right. Now we move on to the interesting one. And by the way, the one that could be a much debate, and I'm going to have Ron share a little bit on this. So in a minute, I'm going to give him the microphone so it comes across good or well. But let me just share a little bit about where some background that I have on this, that is the low statement, husband of one wife. And we, of course, you deal with this when you get over to the deacons also. It's the same verbiage that's used. It's the same standard. And then the question arises, what is he talking about? And the traditional Baptist response or application of this phrase is that a pastor cannot be divorced. Or if he is divorced, the pastor cannot be divorced and remarried. My approach or my understanding of this, and we've talked about this before, can a divorce disqualify someone from this? We say yes. Does it necessarily? We say no. Okay? So there, it's not a cookie cutter type of thing. Okay? Here's what you need to know about Paul and Jesus. When either Paul or Jesus wanted to use the term divorce, they use the term divorce. He does not use the term divorce here. Okay? Now I want you to think about where he's at. He's in a pagan city where he's reaching Gentiles with the gospel of Jesus Christ. They've come into the church, they're growing in the church, they're developing in the church, and many of them had multiple wives. Now, what do you do with those multiple wives? This would be a trouble, wouldn't it? So what are you supposed to do? You're supposed to divorce all these wives and let them go off by themselves? Well, that wouldn't be right for those wives and their children, because that happened before salvation. But the polygamy thing was an issue that they dealt with when it came to church leadership. The husband of one wife. And I believe that primarily with this phrase, he deals with marriage and relationships more in here. But with this phrase, he's dealing more with polygamy than there's no intent on this one with the term divorce. So, with that, I'm going to let Ron share what he's got, because I know he's got a couple things. Go ahead. Come on up.
I'm going to walk around, yeah. Let me start by talking about this, the larger section here. The things that apply to pastors and to deacons are actually, when you think about them, these are qualities of character mostly. He begins with this umbrella term talking about being above reproach. These terms and these qualities of character that he's going to list for us, even though he begins by applying them specifically to pastors and deacons, he's going to go on later in the chapter and say, this applies to the whole church. These aren't things just for pastors and deacons, they're for all of us. But certainly as our leaders, they set the example for us to follow. Now as far as this specific verbiage goes, the first thing that came to my mind when I look at it, well, maybe there's an answer in the Greek. What does the Greek actually say? So I went back and did some serious word study on that to try and understand what it said. Could you open that for me? If you translate it literally, that's what it says. He has to be a one-woman man. And later on, when he talk about the wives, it's, you know, just flips it around, a one-man woman. That, no matter how you bring this into English, husband of one wife, one woman man, because the words for man and husband here and woman and wife are, in this context, are somewhat interchangeable. No matter how you bring it into English, you still have to wrestle with what it means, which is what Pastor said. There's various ways you could look at it. You could look at the polygamy thing. You could look at it as a matter of not being remarried. There's three or four different ways to talk about what it means. As I thought and reflected on this, I thought about the context of what was being said. I did some study also on the culture, tried to figure out. Most of what I read didn't seem to feel that polygamy was a big problem that Paul needed to address. I'm not an expert on that. But in the context, we're looking at qualities of character that began with being above reproach. And we're talking, he's going to talk later in this passage about the importance of being a good family man, of the importance of reflecting well on the message within the community, and there being no unfitness for the office that you hold, both publicly and in the context of the church. So as I thought about it, I said, well, as I compared the different passages here in Timothy, and where he uses the same words, so what does he mean? To me, the most likely meaning, as you compare different Bible translations, I think the newest version of the NIV gets this right. That's my view on it. It says, he must be faithful to his wife. Now, however you come across, however you translate the words, I think in the context of the quality of character that Paul is describing here, you have to have a man or a woman that's faithful to their spouse. I mean, even if you look at it as a matter of you can't have been divorced, I don't think Paul was laying down a hard and fast rule. I think what he would have meant to say is that, well, your pastor can't be the kind of guy who just discards his wife and then goes ahead and marries someone else. But I don't think he's laying down a blanket rule, because if you know anything about divorces, you know that sometimes people leave other people for no good reason. And I don't think that's what Paul was talking about here at all. So, to summarize, in the context, and we can be certainly generous because people will hold different points of view on this, but I think I have a paragraph here I think sums it up quite well. Regardless of which interpretation is chosen, the trait of marital faithfulness appears at the top of Paul's list of desired traits of an overseer. In a unique way, Paul connected fidelity in family life to fidelity to God. If pastors cannot honor marriage vows, how can they honor a commitment to God and His church? Thus, the public role filled by an individual as pastor cannot be separated from the personal role of being a responsible family member. And that, I think, gets at the essence of what Paul intended. So I like the translation, faithful to his wife. That's where I come out on this.
All right.
Oh, one more thing, real quick. Later on, he's going to talk about the list of widows. And he says, she must have been a one-woman man to get on the official widows list. What in the world does that have to do with divorce? I don't know. I think he was saying she has to have been a faithful wife. And it's the same words, just flipped around. So I think you have to look at it that way and see it in the larger context.
Thank you, Ron. All right. Any thoughts, any input, questions on that part? Go ahead.
Polygamy in Israel or in the Hebrew culture was completely phased out at this point, or no?
Say that again.
Polygamy within the Hebrew culture, was it phased out at this, like I'm thinking obviously of Solomon.
I'm actually trying to think of in a New Testament context of anybody that was in polygamous. It must have been pretty much phased out, because if you remember, part of John's condemnation of Herod was, mm-hmm. Well, of course,
Brother Philip's wife.
Yeah, mm-hmm. he did kill it, or how, whatever he did. My mind can't get there right now. But he did talk about the faithfulness to the wife. So by the time we get to Jesus, I don't know of any biblical record of any kind of polygamy in the Hebrew. Maybe they learned from Solomon. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's interesting, though. It's interesting, after Solomon, you don't get a whole lot of polygamy verses at all. Think about it. Eventually go into captivity and stuff, when they come back, you don't get a whole lot of, and then you have Malachi, which is a very strong statement about treating the wife of your youth, in a cruel manner and stuff. Of course, Jesus' condemnation said, "You got to the place where you thought you could just give your wife a notice of divorce. I divorce you. I divorce you. I divorce you, and you're gone." He says, "You missed the whole thing." So yeah, that's an interesting question, because I never even stopped to consider that's pretty well gone by that time.
Romans were not polygamous either. Well, serial like today,
they married one after the other, but they weren't polygamous as such.
So the faithful thing seems to be very, a very, and that would be faithful in marriage, to stay in marriage, to, like you said, not to, so yeah.
Historically, on the mission field in Africa, this has been a challenge when you came into some African cultures where they had multiple wives and they came to Christ, and some of the early missionaries said you had to have choose, basically. So it did kind of like what you did. It put the whole family, these wives, what are they going to do and their children?
Yeah, that.
And so that was a very cruel thing. And I think that these can be difficult in certain things. We don't face that, but, you know, when they did, I think they made some decisions. Not that they shouldn't have encouraged, you know, maybe faithfulness and caring for
right.
them, but.
But if we approach it with the faithfulness thing, which I like that. This broadened this up a whole lot more. This broadened it up not only in actual relationships outside the relationship with your spouse, but today a big thing would be pornography and what Jesus talked about and stuff. You know, all those things could end up a big thing. So I think one of the points I want to make, whether it be, you know, several wives, the changing of wives, changing of the guard, or faithfulness to one wife. I think one thing that's become clear through the years is, again, if Paul meant divorce, Paul had already used that word in other passages, and if he meant divorce, he would have put it there. I mean, we're not talking about someone that didn't know the difference between these two. So,
you mean that he had to be married?
No. And see, that's another, I've had people tell me, so-and-so can't be a deacon or so-and-so can't be a pastor because they're not married.
Well, that leaves Paul out.
What?
Really? Well, I'll tell you what might have actually left Paul out. Just throw this in. The tradition of who Paul was and what happened to Paul. There are those who teach that in order for him to be a member of the Sanhedrin, he had to be married. Mm-hmm. It's a requirement. Okay, so what happened to Paul's wife? Because she never missed again. And as a matter of fact, he makes a statement: "I would that you would be more like I am, alone, because you're not pulled, you know, in a couple of directions." So what happened to Paul's wife? When I've done some background on that, almost every commentator or scholar said Paul had to be married. What happened? Well, some people say she must have died. Well, okay. That's kind of a convenient out. Let's just get out of here and do this.
Yeah.
I think more likely, Paul's wife left him when he came to Christianity. Think about what she would have had to give up if she would have followed Paul. Look what he gave up. Look what she would have had to give up if she would have followed Paul. She would have lost all standing and stuff like that. We don't know that. We don't know who she was. We don't know her standing and stuff like that. But if it was divorced, let's say that she just walked away and divorced him or whatever like that, then that would in some people's mind, that would disqualify Paul from doing what Paul did. Okay? Any other questions or thoughts?
I think it's important when we consider these positions like pastor, deacon, is you really need to know, without being nosy, I think you have to know what happened.
Oh, yeah.
And I've known men who have been divorced that they really caused the whole thing. That's a whole different story. And then there's other men that they want to stay married. Ron Mines. I mean, I walked Ron through. I mean, his wife left and he had no... I mean, he agonized over it over and over and over again. And he tried to save his marriage. He couldn't do it. I mean, mm-hmm. It takes two. And this is a case so many times that...
Yeah.
That people are there. Does that mean they're put on the shelf and never used again because of this? I think that's a tragedy, a double tragedy.
And, you know, we had a young friend named Ken in our school that he married a girl when he was in the military. They moved back here. 2 weeks later, she missed Mama. 2 weeks, she left him. Went back home to Mama. And he had people in the school that told him, and he was studying to be a pastor. You can't be a pastor. you've been divorced. And it is no secret. It is no secret. The guy we're looking at, Luke, he is divorced. And he does not hesitate to tell you that his wife decided she liked someone more than him and left him. And he did everything he could do to try to hold it together, and she wanted the other thing. So that disqualifies him? I don't think so. You know, there are men who are deacons in this church that are divorced, that have been divorced and stuff. But they've shared what happened and stuff. And so, anyways, that's why, you know, it's really not there, except it is there when it talks about faithfulness. And it is there when it talks about leading your own household well and having a, how can you have a good relationship and lead the church when your household is a mess? Mm-hmm. You know, so any other thing like that? Okay. It's a hard issue because I think the church has taught hard and fast rules on this divorce thing. And even Paul, who people think is sometimes very brutal, even when he dealt with just divorce overall, he talked about the Christian woman who was married to a man and was the she wanted to stay with him, but he wanted to leave, and finally he did leave, and Paul finally said, "You're free." Now, what does that mean, you're free? Now, there are some people who say, well, wait a minute, Jesus said if you divorce your husband or your spouse instead of anything other than adultery, then and get married again, then he said, you're guilty of adultery. Well, my next question, well, how long does that last? Are you guilty of adultery for the rest of your life? You know, I don't think that was his intent. I think his intent was more like it was okay. Listen, I'm married to Teresa, okay, and I decide I don't want to be married to Teresa because I want to marry Dan, and that'll work today, won't it? So someone's gonna get this tape on here. So I think what Jesus was saying, it goes back to Malachi, how you dealt with the wife of you dump her to go to someone else. That's adultery.
Yeah.
That's what Jesus was saying. You understand what I'm saying there? We want to make this this hard, fast thing where you say, Jesus said, so does that mean every Christian that has got married again is in a continual state of adultery?
No.
So the point is, what's Jesus saying there? He's talking about the sanctity of that marriage relationship, and not to treat it as something so meaningless that when someone else catches your eye, you just dump what you have and go to the next one, like Malachi says, like Paul's saying right here. Because again, Paul says to the believer, if that other one leaves you, if that other one doesn't want to reconcile, he actually says you're free. And when he says you're free, you know what he means by that. You are free to follow the leadership of the Lord, and that leadership may be that he'll bring someone else into your life that you can spend the rest of your life with. You balance that out with his admonition, it's better to marry than to burn. Yeah. You know, and what are you talking about? He's talking about burning lust.
Yeah.
Is he only talking to those who have never been married? I don't think so. You see, the balance that is there, and the intent of what even Jesus said, what we have a tendency to do as religious, we make this big blanket statement. Can't get divorced. If you get divorced, there's no possibility of ever having a relationship with another person on this face of the earth, so you have to spend the rest of your life alone. Maybe God has that for you, like Paul said. Paul says God, that was, I think he believed that was God's gift to him, that he could spend the rest of his life alone. But he also realized that not everybody can. Mary, you going to share something?
Yeah, only that in our past history in the churches we were involved in, is this really became an issue when people were very legalistic.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a pastor who came from a very legalistic background, but he had gone to to become pastor of this church. One church was more liberal than his background, but man, he wanted to hold everybody to that very legalistic attitude about these things, as that word is written. I know that means divorce. That's it. You know, you can't. And really,
I just think people lose the whole intent of what Jesus was saying.
Right.
And then what you have to do is you have to create a whole second class of people in the church.
Yeah, that's right.
Mm-hmm. You know, and you might as well just take that brand and put it right on their forehead and say you can only be used here, there, or the other thing because of this thing in your life. And that's a terrible way to treat people.
You wouldn't let anyone teach you and have been divorced into
that. Yeah.
Regardless of the story.
Yeah, it's a safety valve for those who don't want to read what the scripture says.
Yeah.
It really is. It's legalism is that way. It's so much easier just to say no.
For those who want to stand in judgment and feel superior.
Yes.
You know, I've had people say that to me as a Southern Baptist. They said, "Well, have you ever done a marriage ceremony for someone who's been divorced?" Well, yeah, you're a liberal. Really. There's very few people that ever call me a liberal, but there are a few out there, you know. I think we've done great harm.
Oh yeah.
To our brothers and sisters in the church, and in my immaturity as a pastor, because that's what we were taught coming up to the thing. That's what we were taught. So I've taught that in the past.
Yeah.
I wish I could go back and pull some of that stuff back. But I've taught that in the past. But I think you know, it's just so easy. It falls in some of those other things. It's easier to label people that way. I feel good about myself. So I've never got a divorce, and I never pushed my wife aside for another lady and stuff like that. But what about my thought life at times?
Yeah.
Has that always been pure? Has that always been right? Well, of course, I'm perfect. So.
Okay, there's the lightning.
Yeah, stand back. So, let me get back here now. Come up here. Go ahead, Kelly, please.
Well, it seems like if someone is divorced, they're shunned in the church. But if someone does any other, maybe they were a drug dealer or something like that, they're brought in.
Let's get that testimony up there. You can't believe how many people I killed before I was saved, but hey. You know, I know. Go ahead.
That's exactly what
you're going to say?
Yeah, we really damage a lot of new believers.
We do. And listen.
Because of what, you know, their testimony, where they came out of.
Right.
You know, whether it's the drug scene or the music scene or whatever, we damage them by going, oh, well, let's put you on this pedestal.
Yeah, when they're not ready.
But
please, I want you to hear the I think what is the heart of Christ and the heart of Paul here. And that is not, when we say these things, that is not to move to a place where we take these things lightly. It's just the opposite. We don't take these things lightly. We, you know, that's why you're not to enter into a marriage unadvisedly. And, you know, my experience as a pastor, particularly with young people, is they don't listen to anybody. They know everything. It's usually 6 months later that I can start counseling them. You know, they look at me when I'm doing the premarital counseling like, you know, you're an old guy. You know what you're talking about. So, but they're not diminishing. Matter of fact, I think what they're doing is they're teaching how precious it should be, marriage should be. But because we are failed people, and I think Jesus answered that. When they said, well, Moses gave divorce, and Jesus said, well, Moses gave divorce because of the hardness of your heart. And basically, folks, that's what it always is. I'm not saying everybody has a hard heart. That's usually the issue. It's a hard issue.
Yeah.
So I think we've got to be very careful that we don't label or make people second class in the church, or put them on a shelf somewhere and say you can't because this has happened in your life and stuff. And we are very good at churches of choosing those things we do that with. So... questions or comments on that before we move on?
There is both sides of it, of course. On the one side, for many people, going through a divorce is the most heart-wrenching experience in their life. And right at the time when they need compassion the most, we're hardest on them. On the other side, of course, is if you find that someone is being cruel to their wife or husband in a way where they're being hateful and they just walk away, I don't think we should treat that lightly either.
No, I think that's the point.
Confront that kind of behavior. So, you know, both sides of that work, and it should all be worked with compassion anyway.
And because we are so segmented today, it's hard to confront that. Because even in church, people say, this is my life, it's none of your business. You know.
Or you ask them to help and they refuse because they believe it. They need to stay.
Well, I've heard people tell me things that pastors have told them about. You need to go back to this abusive situation. You need to be a submissive wife, be treated that way, and that's just terrible. Just terrible stuff.
Well,
it irritates me when someone sends a a lady particularly, I guess I'm male chauvinist when it comes up, but right. back into an abusive situation and say you have to stay there because God wants you to stay in that thing. Are you serious? There's something wrong with your head? I don't mind asking that question. So
I even had a pastor tell me I'd go to hell if I divorced my husband.
I don't doubt that a bit.
And he was very abusive. So, yeah.
It's a sad thing.
It is.
Yeah. Paul.
Well, Solomon was one of the wisest men we ever had.
Now, we've already dealt with Solomon. There's not too much wisdom working there. So.
In Proverbs 25, verse 24, he said, it's better to move to the roof and live with a contentious woman.
You're over on that bridge. I'm going to do a Randy to you. You're on that branch all by yourself, bro. So.
It depends upon what the meaning of the word is.
It is, okay. I remember when they asked Bill Clinton, they said, well, you're a Southern Baptist. And he said, oh, yeah, I'm a Southern Baptist. That means we believe in priesthood and believer, which means we can, basically what he says, we can pick and choose what we want to do. That was his idea, priesthood and believer. It could be wrong for you, but it's okay with me. I'm a priesthood and believer, and I can choose that. I'm thinking, you're an idiot. So, you know. All right. Oh, I've called people idiots before. And then they say, oh, you're calling people names. No, I'm using adjectives. And they're appropriate. All right. So, does that kind of make sense to you all? Because again, it's not a dismissal of God's standards. But we have to understand it biblically and not just, put stuff in here. Baptist, you can look at some, and I talk about Baptist because it's what we are. You can look at some of the requirements that have been given to us through the years, and they don't stand up biblically. I have some precious older people in our church that they want me to say that it is a sin for people to drink wine. I can't say it. I can say it. Now, I certainly believe it's wise. There's a lot of wisdom on choices, and so I understand all that stuff. And certainly for some people, it's wise that they never touch it. Okay? But I can't do a blanket statement to the whole church that says, if you drank wine, you're disobedience to God, or you're... I can't do it. I can't do it biblically.
Now you're in verse 3.
Yeah, he does deal with drinking, but yeah. I jumped ahead. We'll get to that one. All right. So,
okay.
Husband of one wife, or one woman man. Temperate. What's that mean?
Not a drunkard. Self-control.
Basically, have under. We would actually say under the control of the spirit, not given to losing control. Okay. Whatever that may be called. Sometimes it's by liquor, and sometimes it's by just anger, and sometimes it's by all kinds of things. It goes sober-minded, okay? You want someone who thinks clearly. I've said in classes, I've said in sermons where there's something wrong with that man's thinking. I mean, just the first church we went to, the pastor preached on the day we went in view of a call, and I told Teresa, I said, I don't know about you, but I don't even know what he was talking about. It made no sense. And I said, I don't think we're coming here. And the last youth pastor, it was for youth pastor that came there, they voted 60-40%, something like that for us. So Teresa said, oh, don't, she kept doing this. She bugged me the whole time on this. So she kept putting the thing in front of me to tell me to put my resume in and stuff. I said, I don't know. But anyway, so we went there and I said, I don't think so. And she said, oh, well, yeah. I said, okay. I'll go if they give me a 90% vote. And it was in my mind they would never give anybody a 90% vote. So I got a 96% vote. And I'm thinking, oh no. I really was. Because I asked the pastor, I said, how are we going to work together? I was a young minister, just out of school and stuff. How are we going to work together? And in the middle of I'm talking to him, he flips over his chair and starts working on his chair. The thing he said, he basically is what he said to me. You stay out of my way, I'll stay out of your way, and we won't have any conflicts. That's what he says to me in the interview thing. Well, I find out a few months after we get there, he's fooling around with several ladies in the church.
Ooh.
He didn't want me anywhere near him and stuff. So, Teresa.
I was just thinking the reason he didn't get 100% vote, though,
have had facial hair. And a couple of the older ladies do not like facial hair. They told him that later on.
Yeah, a little bit of long hair and stuff. But later on, they called me to be the pastor of the church. So, all right, we're gonna have to stop there. I can't even get through verse 2 tonight. So,
sorry.
That's all right.
That's okay.
I think this is an important thing because. Yeah. You're gonna when you are a member of a traditional Baptist church, this divorce issue, I really think in a lot of ways has been taken completely out of context, and it really is hurtful, and it actually can leave sincere believers spending the rest of their life alone, and that may not be what God has for them, but they wouldn't dare do the other thing because they want to walk in obedience to God.
I've seen it about a church and a half.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's not just, sorry.
From a Catholic background, you have to have your marriage annulled. And
yeah.
I've seen where people haven't gone through that, and they don't go near church anymore because of it.
Yeah.
You
know.
It's not just the Baptist and Catholic.
Oh, no, it's not just the Baptist. I use Baptist as a reference point because that's what we came through. That's what we are. Because I've had people, when I moved through this on my own, where in former churches, we moved to a place where they said, oh, a deacon can't be divorced. And that, I mean, the church that I was at, second church, they had two deacons. They were there, what, 30 years or something like that? Two deacons. And every man I brought up the possibility of being a deacon, they found something wrong with him. And when I left there after almost 3 years, there were still two deacons there. One sat on one side of the church, one sat on the other side of the church, and they fell asleep.
Oh my goodness.
In the sermons. And I started teaching a young adult class there, and then my young adults started coming on Wednesday night. Well, the only ones that ever came on Wednesday night was just the old people, older people, and they would sit there and they expected me to lecture them for an hour and stuff. And I had these young people that started coming to church, and they were used to interaction and stuff, and first time one of them asked me a question openly in Wednesday evening church, you'd think someone's neck was going to be broken. They cranked around, oh, you spoke up to the pastor and stuff, but this was one of those things they were so stringent on, and then when I moved to Mesa, we really started working on this and said, this is just not right, guys. This is not what he's saying. So, all right, we need to stop there. Thank you, Ron, again for filling in.